This is the podcast of Vermont Edition, a production of Vermont Public Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by the financial support of our listeners. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The news traveled fast and it traveled far. The U.S. House failed to pass the $700 billion bailout package yesterday, and stock markets around the world took a nosedive. At the end of the day, the Dow Jones Industrials had dropped 777 points, the largest drop in history. Lawmakers are urging people not to panic, and the U.S. markets do seem to be recovering this morning. How are you feeling? We'd like to get your thoughts on the economic situation and yesterday's House vote. If we have time, we'll read some of them at the end of the program. You can send a note to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. When the bailout package reached the House floor yesterday, 140 Democrats voted for the legislation, 95 voted against it. Congressman Peter Welch was one of those who said no. He said he was, quote, appalled the administration made no proposal for how to pay for this other than putting it on the credit cards of the middle class. Earlier today, I sat down with Congressman Welch to ask about his decision. This wasn't just an administration proposal. It was backed by Democratic and Republican leadership. So I asked Congressman Welch what specific changes needed to be made to satisfy him.
Well, two things. First of all, this is a very serious problem, and we're going to be returning to Washington to get a bill done. And it reflects a crisis in confidence in the banking system. And obviously, people know that it happened because of reckless lending and reckless borrowing on Wall Street. But that undertow can drown folks on Main Street here in Vermont. And anybody who has a 401k, they're saving for their retirement, college funds, those all took a very bad hit yesterday. The market's coming back a little bit today. So there is I certainly recognize how serious this is. But in addition to this confidence issue, we have some underlying economic fundamentals, and I want to make certain that that's part of the bill. Two things for me that are very important, and I think we can improve them, is one, taxpayer protection, because this is a $700 billion bill. It's going to be added to the credit card debt. So, and it'll require that we raise the national debt above $11 trillion. So I'd like to see stronger taxpayer protections in here.
What would that look like?
Well, for me, if we had a very small transaction fee on stock transactions, we'd be able to create an escrow fund, much like we have a transportation fund or an education fund. And as money went into that fund, we'd keep it there and use it to offset the losses that taxpayers will incur when the Treasury buys these toxic debt securities. So that's really a major concern for me, is to make certain that after we pass legislation, a month, a year, 2 years down the line, we don't find the taxpayer saddled with this enormous burden. So that's one. The second is there are a couple of things we could do to make us more practical and less expensive. We could raise the insurance rate or level on federally insured deposits, say to $200,000. We could provide a way of insuring money market funds, which are the go-to accounts for most people. Another thing that we can do is something we did in the 80s in the S&L bailout, and that is have accounting that reflects fair value, not just what's called mark-to-market. These are just practical small steps that could make a huge difference in the actual expense and make the prospects of this being successful greater.
Where was the failure here, though, in the sense that if there weren't enough votes to pass this— shouldn't you have waited? I mean, didn't the fact that you did not pass the bailout plan cause the markets to crash?
Well, the markets obviously reacted to that. But keep in mind, Secretary Paulson came in only 10 days ago with really quite an extraordinary request, and that was to get a $700 billion IOU. That's a serious request. And it was feverish work on the part of the House and Senate leaders. And I give Barney Frank an enormous amount of credit for improving what I think was a very deficient bill. But that's a very compressed amount of time. I think we actually did make a lot of progress. And I'm absolutely urging our leadership to keep working on this, have us back in session this week. And the goal here is to pass a bill that's improved with more prospect of success to shore up the lending institutions we need at less risk to the taxpayers.
But if there weren't enough votes, if this was still a deficient bill, if 95 Democrats, more Republicans said, we can't pass this, why didn't the leadership of both parties who were pushing for this bill say, let's back off, let's not panic, let's give it a couple days and find a new plan?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I know that going into this, the expectation was that the Republicans would probably provide about 100 votes, and they had 66 votes. But the decision to go forward was obviously made at the leadership level, and I don't know the answer to that.
Do you think it was a failure of leadership?
Well, no, I think we've got to get it done. And I think that we have got to address this immediate crisis. But, you know, we can't ignore the fact that we have been creating this mountain of debt, and that part of the market reaction was to the rejection of the plan. But the market's been going down in part because of fundamentals. My view, in addition to doing something for the immediate crisis, give some stability in our lending institutions, we've got to get back to the fundamentals. And that's rewarding work, entrepreneurship, and having more focus on the middle class rather than on speculation and market manipulation.
Just to get a little bit into the atmosphere of what it was like, did you think yesterday when you were on the floor that this was going to pass?
I did, actually, because in general, when the leadership brings legislation to the floor, they're pretty confident it has the votes. And where you had some Republican commitment with the leader, Mr. Boehner, supporting it, I think the expectation on most members is that there would have been 100 votes or so on the Republican side. So I think a lot of members were a little surprised.
What was the atmosphere like on the floor? Was it very tense?
Well, you know, we're taking this very, very seriously. I mean, there's an extremely consequential situation here for our economy and for average Vermont families, for our small businesses, because if they don't have access to credit, our businesses won't be able to meet payroll or get the inventory they need. And if folks see their retirement savings go down, it's going to postpone plans for retirement and make it tougher. So obviously, we have got to address this. But we've got to do it in a way, we've got to do it quickly. But frankly, I think we've got to do it right, with a real emphasis on the long-run protection of the taxpayer, because I think that has the best prospect, if we do it right, to get those 401ks and those IRAs back up to where they need to be to help people.
So what do you say to constituents right now who are watching their 401ks lose money, who are looking at a 777-point drop in the Dow and getting very nervous? What do you tell them about how to protect themselves?
Well, I say we in Congress have to return. The leadership has to get together. We have to find a bipartisan bill that we can pass and provide some short-term stability. I mean, that's the job that we have, and I'm determined that we get back to work and do it, and we do it quickly.
Are you hearing different things from your constituents now since the vote than you were before the vote?
Well, there's always been two strains of reaction. One is outrage. You know, at how in the world did we get here, and how is it with these incredibly lavish golden parachutes for executives who ran their companies into the ground, destroyed jobs? How is it that they caused such a problem and got away with so much money? So there's fury, but it's been tempered by fear, because people know that the undertow that has been created could affect them. And my concern is the innocent people. And the reality is, I'm prepared, as I think most of us are, to do something that's required to protect those 401ks and those IRAs of innocent people, even if collateral consequences, some of the bad guys benefit.
Are you hearing from people, though, that they're angry that you voted no?
People are concerned. You know, I think people get it. They want this market crash to stop. They want our economy to get back to basics. They were hoping that there is, quote, a solution, like passing a bill. But, you know, I also think Vermonters are pretty smart in knowing that it's not as though you can get a vote of Congress to suddenly reverse a decade of reckless borrowing and reckless spending. Now, you know, the reality is it's very sad here in Vermont, because our Vermont bankers and our Vermont borrowers live within their means. We have the second lowest foreclosure rate in the country. Yet, if this bill passed as it was yesterday, every Vermonter would be asked to pay $10,000 for the bailout. So Vermonters are very, very upset about that. But they also know they've worked hard, and they want to maintain, they want to do whatever we can to maintain the value of their savings. That was earned by hard work and thrift.
We're seeing today that the markets have recovered somewhat from yesterday. It looks like they seem to be betting that there will be a plan in place by the end of the week. Do you think that that's a reasonable expectation?
Well, I certainly hope so. And I think that we all know that we need prompt action. My hope is that we can improve this in significant ways that will provide better protection and less risk to the taxpayer. You know, when you get in these pressure situations, there's an enormous desire, quote, to act. In fact, we do have to act. But in that pressure situation, you don't want to regret that you've passed a $700 billion burden to the credit card of Vermonter, of Vermonters and all Americans. So my goal is to work with my colleagues to improve this and mitigate the risk going forward.
And is there a timeline yet?
Well, the timeline is yesterday. I mean, I think there's a great sense of urgency. The market crash obviously had a big impact. I mean, that was Wall Street voting. But on the other hand, I think people are really concerned of two things. One, taking action to try to mitigate the slide. You mentioned the market is up today. But second, I think people do understand that the economic principles we've gotten off the rails here. You know, America's always been at its best when we've had economic policies in Washington that focus on building and maintaining the middle class, people who work. And those are the people who I want to protect, not just in the short run, but in the long run.
I appreciate what you're saying, and I don't mean to push you too hard on this, but, you know, until there is a plan, a lot of people around the country are saying they just feel hopeless. They have no control over the situation. They're waiting for Congress to act. Can you give us any sense of what day we might see a new plan, when there might be a new vote?
Well, I think this is all going to happen in the next week or so. But, we're on recess for the Jewish holidays today and tomorrow. And I've been urging leadership to have us back as early as Thursday. And also work is going on now to see what improvements can be made in this legislation. So I don't know what day this will be done, but I know I speak for most members of Congress in saying that we want to get to it and do that immediately.
In terms of what changes might be made, what are you hearing from leadership about what are the likely changes that both Republicans and Democrats can live with?
This happened yesterday, and it's not like I've been in a caucus because we all left after the vote. But I know the two areas of concern were mitigation of taxpayer risk and focusing the aid on institutions, getting our banks going, rather than the shotgun approach of buying up a lot of bad debt that many economists think will result in bailing out some individual investors and hedge funds, but not benefit the economy or the taxpayer.
Senator Bernie Sanders has proposed that the bailout should be paid for by a 10% additional tax on the wealthiest Americans. Is that something you would get behind?
Well, what I support is paying for it. And what I've been sponsoring and encouraging is to have an escrow fund that's financed in effect by a transaction fee, a very modest transaction fee. It's the same principle that we have with our bank deposits. When you and I put a deposit in our local bank, that's insured. And we pay a modest fee for that. And in exchange, we get security. So if there's a run in the bank, our money's there. And obviously, a lot of people now have their money in money markets. And also, we've seen that we need funds to stabilize banking. So that's an approach that I think makes a lot of sense, and many of us were pushing.
Just before we let you go, in terms of what people should be doing right now, can you reassure Vermonters who are feeling a little panicked?
Well, we're going to act. Okay, in Vermonters, this is the part that is really frustrating as a Vermonter and as Vermont's member of Congress. Our bankers give out loans to people who can repay them. Our borrowers promise to repay the loans they take out, and they do. And we have the second lowest foreclosure rate in the country. And why? It's because of just adhering to basic old-time values, that you borrow what you can afford to repay, and lenders take seriously their obligation to review our credit. And that thrifty approach is, I think, something that's worth preserving. So I can't give advice to Vermonters. They're doing a pretty good job on their own.
But don't pull your money out of the stock market yet? Don't pull your 401k?
Well, don't ask me for financial advice. The folks obviously have to check with if they have a financial advisor or their banker. That's where they want to get that information. But everything I've ever heard is that when there is a sudden stock market in a steep one, like in 1987, like in 2001, most financial advisors, virtually everyone I've ever heard, encourages people to sit tight. I mean, what I can say to people in my job as a member of Congress is that I'm determined to return to Washington and to work as hard as possible to get this done as quickly as possible. And there is this, there it clearly is an air of intense intense desire to get something done and provide some reassurance.
You know, you're very calm and collected and very, you know, it's reassuring how calm you are. But do you feel any sort of knot in your stomach right now?
Oh, I do. You know, it just here's what I'm hearing from Vermonters. And by the way, this is something I was feeling and hearing from them before yesterday when the market crashed. An underlying sense of unease about whether the underpinnings of the economy were working. Because I think people know what Wall Street seemed to disregard, and that is that you simply can't build an economy on debt. That's a house of cards that at a certain point is not going to last. And people were just waiting for that that shoe to drop. So I've sensed that anxiety. I've seen Vermonters being very careful about how they spend their money. They've been saving it. And then this one day hit where they see the value of their IRA savings account go down by 7%. That's brutal. So everything we can do in Congress, we've got to do, and we've got to do it quickly. But we also have to remember that we've got to focus on the long term, because if we do something that's quick and provides temporary reassurance, a week, the market stabilizes, but then the market assesses the situation and sees that what we sold the American people as a solution was really snake oil. And it was $700 billion more on the credit card. It was increasing the national debt to $11 trillion. Then the market will react to that as well. So I think it's very important that we act, but I think it's important that we act wisely.
Congressman Peter Welch, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show, and maybe you can come back when there is a bill that's passed.
Well, I'd be delighted to. I really appreciate it.
Again, we'd like to hear your thoughts about Peter Welch's decision to vote against the Wall Street bailout and what you'd like to see happen next. Send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net, and if we have time at the end of the show, we'll read some of your comments. Stay with VPR for continuing news coverage of the situation, and tomorrow on the program, we'll hear from Senator Bernie Sanders about his economic rescue proposal and take a look at how the economic meltdown could affect our region with economist Tom Cavett. Stay with us right now. We'll be talking about science assessments and inspiring students. This is Vermont Edition.
Vice presidential debates can be full of interruptions.
Worst economy in 50 years.
I'll be happy to answer.
Vice presidential candidates Joe Biden and Sarah Palin will debate October 2nd, and NPR will be there. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Join me for special coverage from NPR News.
Listen Thursday night at 9 on VPR. You can join the conversation on Vermont Edition by calling 1-800-639-2211, a toll-free service provided by Sovereignet. VPR has additional funding today from Shelburne Museum, presenting Mary Cassatt, Friends and Family, a new exhibit of 60 Impressionist works. Information at shelburnemuseum.org. And Stern Center for Language and Learning, building skills and assuring success for all kinds of learners, now accepting fall enrollment. This is VPR, Vermont Public Radio.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Now we're going to shift directions for a little bit to talk about science education in our schools. Like it or not, the federal No Child Left Behind Act has changed the way we look at public education. The law requires testing in various areas, and the release of test results has sparked a lot of talk about how schools are doing. The tests have been phased in gradually. Last year, math was added for the first time here, and this year it was science. Students in 4th, 8th, and 11th grades took the science assessments in May, and the results were announced last week. Acting Vermont Education Commissioner Bill Talbot says he would have liked to see better scores, but he didn't seem too concerned.
We found that 48% of the 4th graders were proficient or better, 26% of the 8th graders were proficient or better, and only 25% of the 11th graders were proficient or better. And we hope that we'll do much better in the coming years. But what we suspect is going on is that schools have been spending a lot of their time implementing the math standards and the reading, language, arts standards, and are now just starting to look at the science standards. This NECAP test, the New England Common Assessment Program tests, are tightly aligned with those standards. So we will be looking at working with schools, you know, talking to them about how they've aligned their science curriculums, and hopefully in future years seeing better results on the test as they work through those standards and get them built into their curriculums.
That was Acting Education Commissioner Bill Talbot. Today on the program, we're going to look more closely at what students should be getting out of their science curriculum and how to teach in a way so they pass the tests and know their science. If you have questions about Vermont's curriculum, what your own children are learning, or ideas for how to improve our science teaching, give us a call. The number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can email vermontedition@vpr.net. That number again, 1-800-639-2211. Joining us now is Pats Fitzsimmons, a former science curriculum specialist who now works for the Vermont Department of Education. She also spent 14 years as a kindergarten teacher where she did teach a lot of science. Pat Fitzsimmons, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Also here with us is Bill Eschholtz. He's a self-described science geek. He teaches at Mount Mansfield Union High School, and he's won both a Milken National Educator Award and Outstanding Vermont Teacher Award from the University of Vermont. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane.
Pat Fitzsimmons, I'll start with you. Can you explain exactly what these assessments, the NECAP assessments, were designed to measure?
NECAP assessment is designed to measure students' understanding of the Vermont grade expectations, and we do that in a variety of ways, that there are multiple choice questions, as well as items where students have to construct a response. And then we have what's really unique to Rhode Island, Vermont, and New Hampshire, an extended inquiry component where students demonstrate their understanding and abilities in relation to inquiry.
In a sense, they do an experiment and then have to talk about it?
Yes, they do. And I think that really makes our assessment pretty powerful, because we're trying to gather information about what we really value in science instruction. And inquiry is a major component.
Now, Bill Eschholtz, at your school, Mount Mansfield Union High School, 39% of 11th graders scored proficient or higher. That's pretty significantly above the state average, but it's still less than half. So do you think that that's a fair reflection of how much students know and how well they're being taught at your school?
I think this is the first year of the test. It's a good benchmark to compare school to school, maybe, and see. And like you said, we did do better than the state average, but 39% doesn't sound very good. But it's the first year of the test. I think Pat said something about it, the commissioner said something about teaching to the test and getting that. I have a little bit of a problem with teaching to a specific test, and it's one more layer of standardized testing that is being put in. You know, my gut reaction is that more than 39% of Mount Mansfield students are proficient in science. Is it something that we can shoot to improve for? I think so. You know, getting our curriculum aligned, we spent several years with the Vermont Comprehensive Assessment Tool getting our curriculum aligned with the standards and putting that in place. And in each unit from K through 12, we have local assessments that are measurable, that can be reported to the state. And this is just kind of one additional layer right now that, again, in its first year, it's a good benchmark. I don't know if I would look at the results too closely and kind of point fingers yet.
Pat Fitzsimmons, what do you think? I mean, if 25% of 11th graders in Vermont are scoring less than proficient or scoring proficient, which means 75%, are showing non proficiency in science, do you think we have a problem in the state?
Well, I think we really need to step back and look at the data and use it to analyze what's happening in programs and see where the strengths in science programs are in schools in Vermont, as well as those areas that we need to improve. We have a ways to go. And, you know, if we still get these results in 3 years, I think I'd be very concerned. But I really have confidence. We have many amazing science teachers in Vermont, and I really have confidence that they will use the data to recognize their strengths as well as build on those areas that need some improvement.
So what do you think it means then if we're scoring a 25%? Is that just because students haven't seen this test before?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons, and the commissioner has talked about some of them, that lack of alignment with the GEs. It is a new assessment, and teachers are getting used to it. I also think that this idea of teaching to a level of cognitive complexity, so the test is designed to assess students in in different categories. It's a little difficult to explain, but in terms of questions that are aligned to looking at, do they know routine information? Can they share conceptual information? Can they synthesize information? So sometimes we're teaching the content, but we're not teaching it to the level of cognitive complexity that's assessed by the assessment.
Our number, again, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Robert in Rutland. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I was going to say, like I agree with what the panel just said, you need to step back and just take a deep breath, because I know the kneecap really reflects more of a gap between low-income students and their peers. Well, national examinations such as the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which Vermont had back in 2005, and at that time showed that Vermont 8th graders, 41% of them, okay, were at or above the science proficiency. You have to realize that they do a better job of measuring Vermont students' progress in comparison to students from across the nation. And I think just last comment is that to look at some of those percentages, just looking locally, they mentioned one local school where they said 63% of middle school students, you know, tested poorly. Well, that was only 17. That's only 17 little pupils. You know, so the 63% makes it sound like it's worse than what it is.
So, Robert, you're not too worried about these test scores.
I certainly wouldn't be not looking at all the tests that have been given back in 2005. No.
Robert, thanks for the call. Pats Fitzsimmons?
The connection to NAEP is an interesting one, and we do typically perform at the top of the heap in NAEP, but it's not necessarily the target. The other piece about NAEP is that they have currently redone their frameworks, so it'll be interesting to see how students across the country score this year in terms of the NAEP assessment, that NAEP has really looked at including the big science ideas and really assessing students on those. So the 2005 gave us some data, but it will be interesting to look at the DAEP data in the future also.
Now, Bill Eschholtz, you teach science, obviously, so I want to know what you think. You said earlier that you have some reservations about having a statewide curriculum that you have to be aligned to, that you have to teach to. What are your reservations about that?
I think some local control within our district. You know, we've got a curriculum coordinator at the district level, and then at each of the levels, we have K through 8, we have the high school. And I think we've done a pretty good job aligning our curriculum. And the fact that we might want to teach Earth Science freshman year, maybe another district doesn't feel like they want to teach Earth Science freshman year. They get it somewhere else. And I think if we look at the grade expectations, if we look at those standards, and as long as it's being put into the curriculum someplace, I don't necessarily think we should expect every single school to teach the exact the same thing at every grade level. And certain teachers are going to have certain strengths that they can play to more than another. But I do agree with Pat, what you said about, I think there are some science classes out there that are just getting contact. It's read the book, what are the content, what are the facts for that? And, you know, we've got to expand that and do some more inquiry and really get the kids to critically analyze what they're doing, collecting the data. And, you know, just some of the things that we do in some of our courses, we get the kids. We've got, you know, a pretty good situation in Mount Mansfield. We've got a river right down the road from us and other things. And we can get the kids out doing labs, collecting data that means something to them. You know, we got kids that might not necessarily think of themselves as science students, but they're fishermen. And all of a sudden you make the connection to, hey, the water quality in this brook is going to affect whether or not I'm going to catch trout. And they can make that connection to it and, you know, have some ownership and start asking those questions. Well, what if this? How can we prevent this?
If they are getting that kind of education and that sort of cognitive connection where they can analyze something and then apply it to a different kind of problem, shouldn't they then score well on the tests too?
I would hope so, and I think that's part of the goal of the test and the department to set it up, that they can think along those lines. And what, you know, one of my big goals as a science teacher is, you know, after a kid comes out of my class, I really wanted to be a critical consumer of the information, is to be able to look at a newspaper and read information about, you know, Vermont Yankee getting relicensing. They're going to be making decisions about this phosphorus in Lake Champlain, and how do all the pieces fit together? How can I look, you know, do I believe everything the Free Press tells me? I'm hearing stuff from here, and just kind of taking all that information, putting it together, and coming to a decision for them. And I think that encompasses all of it.
Pat Fitzsimmons, on the alignment issue, do you think that that's fair enough, what Bill Eschholtz is talking about, being able to have some leeway and do the kind of experiments he wants?
Oh, definitely. We don't have a statewide curriculum. Let me make that very clear, that we have great expectations that were developed to allow schools and teachers to understand what they will be assessed on. And so there's really a lot of flexibility in terms of how you get there. I guess the one piece we're probably not that flexible about is incorporating inquiry into your science instruction. And Bill gave, you know, some great examples of why it's important and why scientific literacy is just critical for students as we enter this 21st century.
We're talking today about how to get students enthusiastic and educated about science. Do you or have you taught science? Do you have a sense of what works and what doesn't? If you've got ideas or questions, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211, or email vermontedition@vpr.net.
Vermont's political parties play a key role in the election process. I'm Bob Kinzel. In an upcoming VPR election special, I'll talk with the chairs of Vermont's major parties about the key issues that define who they are and what they stand for. We'll also discuss their efforts to expand their base of support across the state.
Listen tomorrow night at 7 on VPR. VPR is funded by listeners like you and by the Lodge at Otter Creek in Middlebury, the next generation in adult living. Open now, 802-388-1220. And Burlington's Flynn Center, presenting tap dancer Savion Glover's Bear Sounds, Thursday, October 9th, flynncenter.org. This is VPR, Vermont Public Radio.
You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We're talking today about teaching science. Vermont didn't score very well in the first ever science assessment tests in the NECAP testing this year. So we're looking at how to make science education more interesting and more informative and how to do a little better on those tests as well. If you have questions or comments to share, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 or write to vermontedition@vpr.net. We're talking today with Pat Fitzsimmons, who works with assessments for the Department of Education, and with Bill Eschholtz, who teaches science at Mount Mansfield Union High School. And let's take a call now from Jan in Essex Junction. Hi, Jan. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for letting me add to the conversation. I'm the retired K-12 ESL teacher in Essex Junction, and one item that hasn't been addressed for all the NECAP tests is that fourth graders invariably score much better than the eighth graders or the 11th graders. And this, from my experience, is because the older kids blow the test off. The 11th graders know it has nothing to do with their getting into college. They and the eighth graders know it has nothing to do with their grades. And I seriously think that until there is some sort of connection, an administrator once said to me, it would be a great idea if the 11th graders knew that if all their NECAP scores were appropriate, that they would be admitted to the state colleges, some sort of tie-in, or the 8th graders knowing it tied into their 6-week or semester grade. I think until that time, you're going to see this enormous discrepancy, and it has nothing to do with concepts or facts or teacher quality, et cetera.
Jan, thanks very much for the call. Bill Eschholtz, first of all, do you think that your students are taking this test seriously enough?
I think most of them do. There's definitely some that don't see the connection. They ask me, am I ever going to find out my score? And if they really want to, yes. But in some cases, they may never know what their score is. So there is some disinterest in it. And I think that is a concern. And the motivation for that, I mean, our high achievers, they want to do well on whatever they take, and they're not a problem. But I think the caller, you know, has a valid point that there is a large group of juniors, especially that time of year. Some of them are taking SATs. They've got ACT scores. You know, final exams are coming up in a couple weeks. Some of them have AP exams during that first 2 weeks of May when the NECAP science exam is given. There's a lot of other stuff going on. And I think motivating those students and finding a carrot, a stick, something that will, you know, make it a little bit more important to them is important.
Pat Fitzsimmons, if this test has no teeth in terms of student performance, it doesn't affect their grades, and it doesn't affect adequate yearly progress for schools, what is the incentive to do well on this test or for schools to make sure their students are doing well?
The kindergarten teacher in me would just like students to want to do well, but that might not always be the case. So 11th grade students, I agree, motivation's a little bit of a problem there. I know that some schools are thinking about how to motivate their students. One thing that some schools have done is put the NECAP assessment data on student transcripts. Looking at ways, when I was working in a school system, when we had the last set of science assessments, we used to really try to make the assessment days really positive. There would be snacks for kids, and just trying to create an environment that helps kids to really perform at their very best.
Let's go to Charlotte and talk with Bridget. Hi, Bridget.
Hi. I've been a non-formal educator for more than 12 years. We've talked a lot at nature centers and museums across the country about inquiry and inquiry-based education. I've met a lot of teachers who it takes a lot more time to set up some of those inquiry-based classroom experiments or field trips. I'm wondering what you think about the No Child Left Inside legislation and how that may help get funding to help train teachers a little bit better with inquiry-based teaching.
Charlotte, thank you. Or Bridget, rather, thanks for the call. Pat Fitzsimmons, tell us a little bit about No Child Left Inside, first of all.
I just read about the legislation being passed. I think it was passed in the House the other day, and I don't know the specifics of the legislation, but I do believe it's imperative that we get students outside and find the time to do that and find the time to do that well so that students really spend time looking closely at the environment, raising questions about what's going on out there, collecting data, and then coming to some conclusions and supporting those conclusions with data.
Bill Eschholtz, you already take your students outside. You just said you take them out to see the world. Why do you think that's important?
Especially in a place like Vermont, I mean, a lot of the kids are outside. They're outdoor enthusiasts. They're athletes, hunters, fishermen, and they feel a connection to it. And so when I can get, five kids from Bolton that will join me at 6 in the morning in Joyner Brook to sample water quality and look for macroinvertebrates, and these are kids that are not necessarily pumped up to go to school, it's just a great feeling. And I think it gives them a little motivation, and they can see the connection. And I think a big thing for the science teachers is, and this goes back to the idea about the test and, getting students interested, is the teachers have to model that enthusiasm. The teachers have to be, pumped up about science, and it rubs off. Not every day. There's going to be struggles, but, going into the classroom and modeling, that inquisitiveness, getting them outside, saying, look, hey, do you know what tree this is? And taking them outside, and, a lot of them will. And you can get some kids that might not necessarily be the, academic superstars, but they've been outside a little bit, and all of a sudden they know more than the kid that they usually sit next to them that knows everything inside and out if it comes out of a book. And so it's just, it's a great connection here in Vermont, with Watersheds, our earth science program. We do a mapping unit where we get the kids outside and map their home place. Biology and chemistry, we do a lot with water quality and get the kids down to Browns River and it's just a great connection for the kids, and they look forward to it.
Pat Fitzsimmons, as you've talked about, you taught kindergarten for a long time. Do you get the kids outside in kindergarten and show them the natural world?
We had a great collaborative effort with the local garden club, and we created a butterfly garden. And my dream was that someday I'd be seeing these young children sitting among flowers and looking to see what living things were there, both animals and plants, and that happened. We also had a wonderful nature trail, and we spent a lot of time out there looking closely and seeing, looking at a wetland area and learning about that. So, yes, I use the outside a lot. I think it provides a context for science, for literacy, and for math, and that we're missing really important opportunities when we don't bring our kids outside.
Now, one of the things, go ahead, you want to
I was just going to say, that was perfect, Pat, because I look
Thank
at
you.
When I first moved back to Vermont from Seattle, I substitute taught, and I loved kindergarten through third grade. The kids just had such a sense of wonder and awe. And they lose that. Some of them do. And when you get to high school, some of them, it's like, I've seen it before. But just to instill that excitement and just wow, that's really happening inside me right now, or you know, I never noticed that before. And just to get them just to realize the immensity of science out there and what everything is, you know, that's the hook.
So the trick is really not to lose it, to be good science instruction.
Exactly.
And we haven't mentioned that yet, that it's really imperative, well, really important, that there's a systemic approach to science from K through college so that kids continually build their conceptual understanding of important science ideas.
One of the other things that still seems to need to be addressed is the fact that low-income students typically score lower than their better-off peers. This test was no different than that. In grade 4, only 31% of low-income students were proficient. In grades 11 and 8, only 12% compared to about 25% of the average. So as teachers, can you think of good ways to address that issue and make sure that income gap and disparity shrinks?
I think some of it is some of these students from low-income families don't have the opportunities that other kids do in terms of going to a museum, taking a summer vacation to Martha's Vineyard, seeing some different places. And, you know, as much as we can provide that in school to take them outside, bring them some different places, bring them down to Button Bay, let them see some different things and just kind of expand what they're able to see and, you know, encourage that. Because a lot of it, I think, is opportunities that they haven't had outside of school. So anything that we can, you know, do to provide additional opportunities in school is going to benefit everyone. But I think the lower income students in particular.
Pat Fitzsimmons.
And we do have some schools that were successful with high poverty populations. We need to go in and look and see what those schools are doing that are helping their students to be successful.
Now, before we let you both go, you're both very enthusiastic about science. Pat Fitzsimmons, what makes you love science and what made you want to teach it?
I didn't really know I was teaching science. I thought I was doing constructive play, and then somebody gave it the name science, and I said, oh, if I do science, people will think that's, you know, important, because that's what we do in school, science. But then that gave me a framework for thinking more about how I taught. And I guess what I love about it is being with students and, you know, being with kids the first time they see the rings around Saturn, or getting a pond sample from a sample of pond water and looking at it under a microscope and watching kids' whole bodies light up and become engaged in the learning process. So for me, that those continual opportunities to provide learning experiences that really allow students to use all of their senses and to learn in a way that really makes sense to them, to help them to build that knowledge, has been a great experience.
And Bill Eschholtz?
And I'm still just a kid. I mean, the sense of wonder is just, I mean, the fact that my body has so many moving parts and all the stuff that could go wrong, and it works pretty well as is, it just amazes me. And just to pass that on to the kids and have the kids all of a sudden have that aha moment that, oh, wow, that's kind of neat the way it happens. And I can't emphasize that enough. It's just to get them to realize how incredible things are out there and how they, you know, they can actually understand that they work.
Well, Pat Fitzsimmons and Bill Eschholtz, I want to thank you both very much for coming to the program today. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
You're welcome. It was good to be here.
Pat Fitzsimmons was a longtime kindergarten teacher and elementary science curriculum specialist. She's now with the Vermont Department of Education. And Bill Eschholtz is an award-winning science teacher at Mount Mansfield Union High School. We asked for your comments in response to our interview earlier this hour with Congressman Peter Welch on his vote against the bailout plan. Here are some of the emails we received. Steve from Barrie wrote, quote, "While the market drop had a negative impact for me personally, I applaud Congressman Welch for his courage in opposing the legislation." Rob from Rutland also supports Welch's decision to vote against the bailout. He writes in part, "Let the large national banks fail. Vermont banks have been very careful in their lending policies and face virtually no exposure from the subprime lending crisis. In addition, those banks and other institutions that engaged in poor credit transactions deserve to fail. Why are we focused on purchasing bad debt from deadbeat financial institutions? Let's begin to focus not on large institutions, but on individuals and make their lives better." Tom from Warren has a suggestion for lawmakers. He says, Why not have the government purchase part of the mortgages to keep people in their homes and absorb some of the losses on lender balance sheets to stabilize the banks? This should stabilize the derivatives that are based on shaky mortgages without giving a blank check to Secretary Paulson or Wall Street. Rebecca in South Stratford has this comment. I was disappointed that Representative Welch did not answer the question about whether he supported Bernie Sanders' proposal to pay for the bailout by a tax on the wealthy. Is this proposal bold Bernie at his best, or is it demagoguery? And if so, why? We deserve to know one member of our delegation's view on the proposal of another. And here's what John from Rupert has to say. I'm a longtime strong Democrat, way back to the days of Phil Hoff, and I have been impressed with Mr. Welch's first term until now. He has made a huge error voting against this bill. Unfortunately, many of my neighbors feel this is a bailout of Wall Street. It is not. Rather, it is a rescue of our entire banking system. It's Mr. Welch's job, as well as his leadership's, to educate his constituents about this crisis. Thank you for all of your comments. We always welcome them at VermontEdition@vpr.net. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk with Senator Bernie Sanders about his economic rescue proposal. We'll also take a look at how the economic meltdown could affect our region with economist Tom Cavett. So keep your comments and questions coming right to VermontEdition@vpr.net. Thanks for listening. We welcome feedback and suggestions for Vermont Edition. Contact us anytime at vpr.net.